Hello and welcome to Radically Distinct Radio. I'm your host, Jen Morgan, and today I have Kripa Upadhyay. Kripa Upadhyay.
Yes.
Yes. Oh, I knew I was going to do it wrong, but it's such a beautiful name, but it is a challenging name to say.
Well, you've got half the alphabets in there, so you know.
Like, I do have the alphabet there. Like, okay, somebody has had to have butchered that name worse than me.
Do you
have
yes.
Who? Tell me.
Oh, gosh, this was a couple of years ago. My prior boss was a criminal defense attorney, and he sent me up to Eastern Washington to cover a hearing for him. And this was in Superior Court up in Yakima. And the judge looked at the name of the client, and you know, I was appearing as the attorney. And he kept very quiet. And I've become accustomed to that whenever professors and such, you know, get to a name and they keep quiet for about 5 minutes, my hand just sort of goes up instinctively, and it's like, yeah, that will be me. And I hear him look at the clerk and go, what is that? Up the highway? And I'm like, yeah, up the highway. Yep, that would be me, up the highway.
Okay, well, that's way worse than me.
Yeah, oh gosh. I've heard all versions at this point.
All right. Well, Kripa is an immigration attorney and the managing partner at Orbit Law. And Orbit Law is a client of mine, and they specialize in immigration law for tech and biotech companies. And today we're going to talk about creating a new narrative around the conversation of immigration and the dynamics of diversity here in the U.S. and abroad. I'm excited that you're here. And again, I'm sorry that I butchered your name. I'm going to get past it. Tell me, why did you decide to become a lawyer, and why focus on immigration?
Well, I think the immigration part is easy. It's obviously very, very personal, right? I'm a first-generation immigrant myself. I came to the U.S. in 98. I moved here for undergrad. And then I stayed, and so I sort of went through the process myself. My family went through the process of coming here via my aunt, who had filed paperwork for my mom. And people that are familiar with the immigration system will know this, but I mean, so to come in as a family member, right, you have to have a U.S. citizen parent or child or sibling file an application for you. And for the people that are coming in via a sibling, those applications, depending on where you're born, can take anywhere from 12 years, which is what they call the rest of the world category, mm-hmm. to 24 years for the Philippines.
Okay.
To, I believe, Mexico is now 25 years.
Wow.
And so you're really just waiting for that amount of time for a visa to become available. Long story short, immigration, because it's personal. Mm-hmm. I think the other side of it, too, is just based on personal experiences of growing up. I've always been very, very intrigued with world events and policy and, you know, things that are happening in the world. And immigration is one of those areas that, as an area of law, it's very much affected by politics, as we've seen with this present election cycle. But it's also an area where, I mean, you're hearing about refugees coming in, right? And mm-hmm. for me, I think I was drawn to the area because people are either moving to a different country because they're in search of a better life,
yeah,
because there's something wrong in the country that they're from,
yeah,
or they're in search of better opportunities because those aren't available in the country that they're from.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so for me, that's very interesting and it's very intriguing. And it involves people from different cultures. It involves different languages. It involves different government types. So it really just appeals to the things that I find fascinating on different levels.
Mm-hmm. What was your undergrad? You said you came here for undergrad.
I did. I came here for undergrad. For the first year, I had visions of sociology. I don't know. I wanted to go work with the Maasai Mara, and I was going to go live in a jungle somewhere and work with the Maasai. That was my that was my harebrained scheme at one point. And then I thought, okay, no, maybe I'll become a counselor. And so I was, maybe I'll do psychology. And then I was working with immigrant communities in California at the time. I lived in Los Angeles, and so I was working with immigrant communities there. And the more I worked with them, the more people told me that I ought to consider law school.
Yeah.
And that was the furthest thing from my mind. And so I think it was my second year in undergrad, I decided on political science and pre-law as my major. And so that's what ended up in law school.
Okay. And didn't you have an actual experience with a legal case that...
Yes.
Yeah. Can you talk a little bit about that and how that inspired you to choose law school?
Yeah. So when I was in Los Angeles, I worked with this nonprofit. It was called the South Asian Network, and it's just a phenomenal organization, and they're actually still in existence. I think they actually celebrated their 26th anniversary not too long ago, like last week. But SAN was founded by a group of South Asian professionals that were really friends. And it came up from, I think, an understanding of not all South Asians obviously spoke the language and had access to resources, right? Not all of them spoke English. Not all of them had the ability to reach out and like speak to police officers because they didn't speak English, or they had concerns about their religion, let's say, or, you know, there were all of these issues. The time that I started my work, I really started in 99 as an interpreter. And then, unfortunately, right after 9/11, hate crimes against the Muslim community and those perceived to be Muslim just skyrocketed. And Los Angeles in particular was very heavily hit. And so during that time, my work changed drastically from doing more interpreting to doing more community organizing and advocacy around hate crimes.
Mm-hmm.
And a part of the work around hate crimes also involved understanding that because of the tensions that the community was undergoing at that time, domestic violence within the South Asian, and when I say South Asian, I mean like Pakistan, people from Pakistan, India, Nepal, Bangladesh, Sri Lanka, Bhutan, right? So the South Asian continent. Because of the anxieties or pressures, because of the hate crimes and because of comments, because of fear of reprisals against that community, instances of domestic violence were actually on the rise within the community.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the cases that I got involved with during the time that I was with SAN was regarding this one lady who was from Punjab, had been forced really into an arranged marriage with a gentleman that lived in Los Angeles. And she was from Punjab, didn't speak English. She'd been brought into the U.S. to obviously as his wife, but didn't speak the language, didn't know anybody, had zero social support of any sort. One thing led to another, and she had effectively been abandoned with two young children and eventually ended up flinging herself into the ocean. And religiously, it had a lot of significance for her.
Mm-hmm. Flinging herself into the ocean to die?
Yes.
Okay.
But in her mind, it was more of a test of God's will, right? It's like, if I'm meant to die, then so be it. But if I'm meant to for something else, then you're going to save me. That was her thought process.
Mm-hmm.
What ended up happening, though, was that she ended up being charged with two counts of murder or attempted murder.
And that's because she threw herself with the kids?
The kids.
Oh my gosh, okay.
So that's where I got, the whole community really got involved. And there was a lot of advocacy that was done. The end of the story being that the husband that had been beating her and battering her and abusing her, nothing happened to him. She ended up being found not guilty, but not guilty by reason of insanity. And so having to have the kids taken away from her.
Mm-hmm.
And then also having to spend about 6 months in a facility for the criminally insane, where she was able to get some form of mental health counseling, but still having to have the kids taken away from her. And so that work, the work around hate crimes post 9/11, a lot of the work that I was doing around like the Patriot Act. I don't know if you're from, you know, like which Edward Snowden actually blew up not too long ago.
Yeah.
So there was a lot of work around the Patriot Act about tapping of phone lines for people that were Muslim or perceived to be Muslim. Right around that time, there was also a program called NCRs, which was targeted specifically towards Muslim men between the ages of 18 and 30, I think it was, that were in the United States on any sort of visas, where they had to go to immigration and register yourselves. And if there was anything amiss, or even if you were within status, you'd done nothing wrong, but immigration agents thought there was reason to detain you and question you, then you were being taken. In Los Angeles' case, you were being taken to the high desert, to Palm Desert, to the detention center up there.
Yeah.
And so there was just a lot of advocacy going on around that time. And so I was working with, you know, on the hate crime side of things, I was working with attorneys from the U.S. Attorney's Office and the District Attorney's Office. And then on the domestic violence side, I was working with defense attorneys and prosecuting attorneys. And so.
And you were like a spokesperson at this point?
I was interpreting. I was, I guess, giving them cultural background, cultural sensitivity issues, you know, sort of explaining the cultural components of why things were happening or why people were. For example, when law enforcement came to a house and there was a complaint about hate crimes, people were afraid to answer the door.
Yeah.
Right. And they wouldn't understand why.
Okay. Right.
And for them, it was, well, we're trying to help and these guys don't want to help. They don't want the help.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was saying, no, it's not that these guys don't want the help. These guys are scared to death of opening the door because they're not quite sure what it is that you're coming for.
Yeah.
Right. You have to understand this from their perspective.
Right.
You're coming in full uniform.
Yeah.
Hand on your gun. They don't speak the language. They have no idea what it is. You're screaming at them when you're telling them to open the door.
Yeah. It doesn't feel safe.
It doesn't feel safe.
Yeah. So this is what inspires you to say, you know what, I think I can make a difference with a law degree.
That was the impetus behind it.
Yeah. Okay. And just like, so I want to just kind of fast forward to, like, I don't know, just not that long ago. You were recently working on some Afghanistan, sorry, women from Afghanistan that had been deported, right, from their own country. And they were in Canada. Is that correct?
I still am working with people from Afghanistan that are at the detention center, at the immigration detention center in Tacoma, that are seeking asylum. Because they cannot go back to Afghanistan because the Taliban is after them. Yes.
Okay. And they're women, right?
Some are women. Most of them are men. Yes.
Okay. So there's a real social justice behind your desire to do immigration law.
Yeah. I mean, particularly when you look at the Afghan, the cases of the Afghans that I have, because every single one of them is being persecuted by the Taliban because they were working with the United States in some way, shape, or form.
And the United States is not letting them come here? Is that the idea?
Well, the United States has not made available the number of visas. So there are special visas available.
Mm-hmm.
It's called SV1, actually. SV1 visas that have been designated by Congress and that are technically available to, let's say, interpreters or people in Afghanistan that have assisted or helped the U.S. effort there. But because, again, political winds, this thing about security, and, you know, you've got, unfortunately, voices from one side of the political spectrum that have gone on record publicly and have referred to refugees as snakes, as criminals, as things that are to be feared and loathed and not welcomed. It does not help when people are fleeing and or being made to flee, rather.
Mm-hmm.
For example, one of the people that I was able to win their case just 2 weeks ago, his father was murdered by the Taliban. His father was killed by the Taliban because he had jewelry stores inside the four Air Force, inside the four military bases in Afghanistan, where he sold traditional Afghan jewelry. But the U.S. troops went up to him and said, would you be able to give us crosses or rosaries or would you be able to carve boxes for us to keep our Bibles, store our Bibles? Mm-hmm. And so he started making them because they asked him to. Mm-hmm. Right? He's Muslim. Mm-hmm. Taliban found out about it, charged him with being a Christian on the sly, and pulled over his father's car while his father was delivering a shipment of goods that they had made. And the car at that time was filled with crosses, rosaries, crucifixes, and the boxes that they had requested that they could store their Bibles in.
Yeah.
So they pulled his 70-some-year-old father out of the car, shot him, left him on the roadside, and left a note saying, "This is what happens to spies of Afghanistan that work with the infidel United States," and left him on the road. And then called the house and told the son, "This is where your father is. Go pick him up."
Oh my gosh!
And that's exactly what's going to happen to you.
Oh my gosh!
Right, and so now he obviously cannot go back to Afghanistan. And that's just one. I mean, that's one of many, many cases, unfortunately, right now.
So why do you think that immigration here in the United States is such a taboo subject?
You know, honestly, I don't know that it's taboo. I think, unfortunately, like I said, it's very, very prone to political winds. Mm-hmm. I think, unfortunately, and again, I'll be the first to admit to this, I may be biased just because my own experience, but I think, unfortunately, there is a very real tendency to take the easy way out and blame the other for a whole host of issues, right? I lost my job. I can't find a job. Oh, it's because the Mexicans are taking it. I can't find a job in IT. Oh, it's because all these Indians are coming in and getting paid pennies on the dollar and they're taking my jobs away. I can't find a job in... You know, I've been looking for 6 months. I can't find a job. Well, because all these Mexicans are coming in and working at the restaurants. It's easy to blame the other. It's easy to demonize somebody that is not like you.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, I think there is a very easy way out for a particular segment of the political powers that be within the United States to capitalize on that, as we've seen.
Mm-hmm. And I think like politically,
yes. And I think unfortunately, the last few months have been a prime example of that. Mm-hmm. Right? I mean, from comments about Mexicans being rapists and murderers, and some presumably being good people, to Filipinos being inherently criminal, to, like I said, refugees being snakes, to Syrian refugees that are being bombarded and bombed being compared to a bowl of M&M poisoned candies. I mean, there's, it's just one after the other. So I don't think it's taboo. Mm-hmm. I think, unfortunately, it's as I said, it's just that there's this propensity to paint them as the other so that it's easier to dehumanize
and separate,
strip away the humanity so that it's easier to separate.
Yeah. And, I think what I think is really interesting, I think lots of things are interesting about you, but one thing that really stood out when I was getting to know you is you're from Nepal, and your father was very active politically in Nepal politics or in South Asian politics. How would you describe that?
South Asian politics. My father's been in and out of jail since the time he was 13.
That's hilarious, and you don't mean it the way that sounds.
He was a student leader.
What kind?
Student leader, anti monarchy. So if you know about Nepal's history, we had an absolute monarchy in Nepal until not too long ago. And there have been periods when, we've had an absolute monarch and then he was removed and we've tried a democracy and then that failed and then the king came back and that failed. And so, then we've had a Maoist insurgency for about 10 years and that failed. And now it's back to some sort of democratic government.
This is since you've been growing up. This is how
yes.
you've grown. Okay.
Yeah.
Interesting.
So since I was born, we've gone through absolute monarchy, democracy, Maoist insurgency back to democracy. But yeah, my father was in the democracy movement. And so he's been in and out of jail, like I said, because you weren't allowed to be a part of a political party at that time. The first time he went to jail, he was, I think he was 12 or 13.
Wow.
And it was because he showed a black flag to the king.
What did that mean?
A black flag meaning that, you know, the king was illegitimate, basically. He had no power to rule over the people.
Okay.
And he got to go to jail and got a couple of beatings with a nice big cane, like a bamboo cane, I think they used at that time in Nepal. But that was him.
What was dinner like with this guy? I mean, so here's where I'm coming from. Like my dad was very, he's a very strong opinion about things. And when I was Ross Perot, like this is my first memory of having any education from my parents on like politics and the president. And it was when Ross Perot was running. And I think Michael Dukakis, I'm going to totally ruin it, but I think it was Michael Dukakis then. But it was Ross Perot, you know, and he's sitting down and he's explaining the independent party and he's explaining these things. Like, seriously, I was really young and I remember being like, oh, he's like really passionate about this.
Mm-hmm.
But what was dinner like at your house?
It was interesting. I mean, it was very much open house. We never knew who was coming in. You know, there'd be days when it was just my sister, my mom, dad, and I.
Yeah.
And there'd be days when there'd be, you know, 5 people or 10 people or, you know,
like some political people
that had, yeah, like party workers that had just shown up and that were being fed. And there were days when my sister and I would get roused from our beds and told, okay, yeah, you guys are going to sleep on a sleeping bed in mom and dad's room. And why? It's, oh, because so and so needs your room. Well, why do they need my room? Why can't they just go home?
Okay.
We were young, you know. I mean, we were just kids at that time. I'm like, what do you mean he needs my room? What happened to his own house? Why can't he just go home?
Yeah. And did they talk to you about politics when you were a kid? I would imagine that. Were you included?
I mean, it was just there.
It was just there.
I mean, it was the air we breathed. It was there.
Yeah.
You know, I mean... We knew there were times when he wasn't coming home because he was going to end up in jail. You know, we knew when we were home my sister and I went to boarding school, and so when we were home on vacations, we knew not to go into certain areas because that probably wasn't the best thing for us to do.
Yeah.
But I mean, it was great. You know, I mean, there was a lot of attention paid in terms of us being made aware of where we were versus, I guess, in terms of the privileges, if you will, right, that we had in terms of the benefit of an education and what was expected of us in terms of giving back to community and giving back to society. And my mom was a social worker her whole life. And so we were, even from a very young age, like we were made to understand in very stark terms that the life that my sister and I had was not the life that every other person in Nepal had.
Mm-hmm.
It was made explicitly clear to us.
Yeah, that you had the responsibility.
That we had the responsibility of doing something about it.
Interesting. So let's talk, I want to talk a little bit about the education system that you experienced, because, you know, why are there so many people with tech education coming out of South Asia? Like, what the heck? And
so there's a joke, and it's not really a joke. I mean, it's you know, it's one of those things where it's not funny because it's actually so true. But if you talk to any South Asian, I mean, if you talk to any Indian, Nepali, Bangladeshi, Pakistani person, they will tell you this. The only careers that most parents are aware of in that part of the world, right, in South Asia, the only careers that parents are aware of that you get to choose from is engineer, doctor, or lawyer. Those are your 3 options, right? There's no such thing as a teacher. There's certainly no such thing as a musician or an actor or anything from the liberal arts. Like, don't even think about it.
Okay.
Right?
Yeah.
Engineer or doctor. And if you can't, then at least be a lawyer.
Okay.
Right? Like, nothing less than that.
Okay. Got it.
And if you're talking about the education system, the way that that works is, number one, and I think I need to say this up front, every school teaches English.
They're right. English born. Wait, what do you mean? They're English.
Every school teaches English. That's at least if they're not
like from England.
No, I mean they have English language classes.
Oh,
right. So
oh,
I mean, like,
you mean they speak English? Yes. They speak. That's the first. That's the language.
That's not necessarily. They may not necessarily speak that as the medium of instruction in every school.
Mm-hmm.
But there's at least one, if not two, classes in English language and English literature in every school.
Okay.
Right? So there's a distinction in that part of the world between what they call an English medium school versus a non-English medium school.
Okay.
And when they say English medium, it means the medium of instruction is English.
Got
so
it.
All of your classes are in English. Everything is in English. In a non-English medium school, your classes are going to be in the language of the state or the language of the country, but you're still going to have English language or English literature mm-hmm. in your core subjects, right? But from, I'm going to say about grade 3 to about 10, you don't choose your subjects, right? So I didn't go to high school here, but I understand that at high school here you have some
mm-hmm.
core subjects that you have to complete, and then the rest of it you sort of get to figure out, and you
yeah,
get
you
to
work
experiment.
With the counselor. Yeah, you work with the yeah. counselor based on what you how you score
right.
usually.
No, no, we didn't have any of that.
Mm-hmm.
Right, there's no room for creativity in that part of the world. You have math, and when they say math, it's not just you know like one math class. It's algebra, geometry, trigonometry, arithmetic. And science is biology, chemistry, physics. And you complete each and every one of those classes
mm-hmm.
from the time that you are, about 7, 8 years old,
mm-hmm.
all the way up to at least 10th grade, right? You complete that. The system in India and the system in Nepal, at the 10th grade, you have what they call your school leaving certificate, which is they basically test you on your last 3 years of education in high school.
Mm-hmm.
And the marks that you get at that point determine effectively what happens to you the rest of your life.
Okay.
Right? So
yeah.
at the 10th grade level, let's say you complete your 10th grade exams and you get what they call 90% marks. So you score in the 90th percentile, right? Then you can opt into what they call the science stream. So then you can go into a stream where they focus on the sciences,
mm-hmm.
right? So most of your classes are going to be chemistry, biology, physics, science-based,
mm-hmm.
tech-based. And if you're between 75 and 80, then you're in the commerce, right? So then you have accounting and financing and things like that. And anything less than that is the liberal arts.
Okay. Okay.
So there's just a very, very strong focus on...
The smartest go here.
Well, now in the U.S., there's this thing about STEM.
Yeah.
Right? There's this real push for STEM education and STEM schools. India, China, and Nepal have had STEM education. We just haven't called it that.
Yeah, didn't you say, you told me, I think they're like 30 years ahead of the
they're
US.
30 years ahead, because that's been the core curriculum in that part of the world.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, it's been STEM education all along.
Mm-hmm.
There's obviously massive disparity, right? Because, I mean, obviously, India, Pakistan, Nepal, to a large part, are still developing countries.
Mm-hmm.
So the people that you're seeing coming into the U.S. that have the technology degrees are to a large part people that came from families that could afford to give them that education.
Yeah.
There is still a very vast population of the community that doesn't get to go to school, right? Much less finish.
Okay.
So there is massive disparities within those countries.
Mm-hmm.
But for the segment of the population that has the opportunities, there's always been a very, very structured environment as far as school is concerned.
Yeah.
And that environment has always made a priority, has always paid priority to what is now in the West being referred to as STEM education.
What do you know, like, what spawned that, like, you know, 30 years ago? Like, what was the decision? How did they have that insight then? To focus that way, and I mean, it really gave a like an advantage to that part of the world, really.
Yeah, I don't know if there was anything.
We'll have to look it up. We'll have to look it up next time. Yeah, sorry. Yeah. I was just curious if there was like one particular leader who came up with that idea. But so when you talk about business in South Asia, here in the United States, there's a lot of women in business, and there's still a huge gap between the number of women in the highest level of leadership and the number of men. How is that over there? You know, I would imagine it would at least be a similar disparity, but maybe more so.
Yes and no. It's that part of the world is very much a walking, talking, singing, jumping, screaming contradiction in every sense of the word. South Asia and the countries of South Asia in particular, Nepal, India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, Sri Lanka. What am I missing? I don't think I'm missing any other country. Sri Lanka, Pakistan, Bangladesh, Nepal, India, each one of those countries has had a female head of state at least once, right?
Right.
The U.S. is only now thinking about the possibility of having a female head of state.
Yeah.
Bangladesh right now, I believe, is the only country in the world with a female head of state and a female head of the opposition. And that's been the way. It's been like that for the last couple of years, actually. So in some respects, women have broken the glass ceiling.
Yeah.
If you look at it from a particular angle. And that's true in Pakistan. Pakistan has had a female head of state. India has had female head of state. Nepal has had female prime minister and a female president more recently, as has India. But again, as I said, it's a walking, talking contradiction, because if you look at society on the whole, the status of women or the opportunities given to women, there's still massive room for growth. There's still a lot of work to be done there. You know, those communities, those countries are still grappling with issues like access to education for women or girls, because the traditional understanding is, why educate our girls, right? They're going to get married and they're going to go to somebody else's house, right? They're going to become somebody else's property. Why educate your girls? And that's still something that certain segments of the population believe. So there's definitely work to be done there in terms of access to education for all girls across the board in society. And the same is true for business, right? I mean, there are business houses, obviously. There are large-scale corporations in each of those countries, all across South Asia, that are led by women. I mean, and there are South Asian heads of, I mean, Fortune 500 companies in the U.S., Indra Nooyi at Pepsi being, you know, prime example. But that's not the norm. So, I mean, on the one hand, yes, you've got female heads of state, but that doesn't mean that because we've had female prime ministers, that necessarily has translated to more opportunities for women downstream.
Yeah. Interesting. Okay. So when it comes to, you know, immigration here in the United States, why is it a benefit for people who are born here for there to be immigration here in the United States?
Why?
Like, in other words, why is it a benefit to this country to have immigrants come here to work?
I will give you this answer from an immigrant's perspective, right? I think everything, and I don't know if and I grapple with this. You know, I became a U.S. citizen later in life, obviously, but I think the idea of American is a difficult concept, right? What is American? I think we've talked about this previously. My version or vision of an American is very different from your version or vision of an American, which is very different from somebody from the African American community, which is very different from someone from a First Nation member, right? I mean, the very different visions and versions of Americans. What have immigrants given to the United States? Again, like I said, I will answer that from an immigrant's perspective. Maybe I'm more attuned to it as an immigrant. because I pay attention to these things. It is my bread and butter. It is literally my livelihood. But the banking system in the United States would not be what it is today without Andrew Carnegie, right?
Mm-hmm.
Immigrant.
Yeah.
Much of the economic institutions today, George Soros, immigrant. Technology today, I mean, Andre and Sergey, right? Mm-hmm. Larry Brin.
Google, yeah.
Google. Apple. I mean, yes, there were family, there's this family history there that maybe he didn't want to own up to, but his father was a Libyan immigrant,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
So what have immigrants given to the United States? I would say a heck of a lot, actually.
The economy.
Right?
You know, a big part of our economy.
They have contributed in ways that literally touch every single facet of our daily lives.
Mm-hmm.
And I've only named the biggest people. Right.
Yeah.
I mean, you have doctors, engineers, people that are working on innovations that change lives, that, I mean, vaccines are being developed, medications are being developed. Immigrants are truly in all facets, every walk of life.
Mm-hmm.
Right. If you're looking at, I guess, bare numbers, and again, this is something that I... think is maybe misunderstood, not stated enough. I'm not quite sure what. Undocumented immigrants, or the people that are otherwise referred to as illegal, and I don't use that term. No person is ever illegal. I don't even know what an illegal person is. You're a person, you're a human being. An undocumented individual or undocumented individuals in the United States on average pay $20 million or $1 billion in taxes every year, right?
Mm-hmm.
But they have no right to actually access public benefits,
mm-hmm.
right? So there's that.
Yeah.
There's a massive amount of money going into the U.S. economy and treasury mm-hmm. from people that are in the United States. And the way that I explain this is, look, people are coming into the United States. And I understand that there may be friction now and there's fears of, okay, but they don't assimilate. Well, what does that mean? Right? What does assimilation mean? If it means an expectation of, well, they need to stop speaking their language, I don't know that I agree with that.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, obviously, I speak English. I speak 5 languages. I think that's a good thing.
Yeah.
Right, I mean, and there are studies to support this. People that speak, children that speak multiple languages actually use more parts of their brains frequently. I think it's a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
Right, I think having an idea of where the world is and how the world works and people's different cultures and foods and, you know, religions from different worlds and how those interact or don't interact for that matter.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I mean, when you invite somebody to your house, do you serve pork? Do you serve beef? Do you not serve either? Right? I mean, we've had this conversation.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like when we were planning the food festival for the office, like we went through this. It's like, okay, well, you can't have pork because we might have people that are Muslim. Well, you can't have beef because you might have people that are Hindu. You can't put the pork next to the beef because that's not kosher. And you've got to know these things. I mean, yes, it's work, but... You know, God love diversity. That's what makes us good, right?
Yeah, definitely, 100%. Yeah, I don't know. That assimilation conversation is a very interesting subject because people really want you, if you're going to live here, I mean, I've heard many people, you're going to live here, you should be like an American, whatever that means.
See,
yeah, it is a very, like, yeah, what does that mean? That's a very good question.
I don't know what that means.
I mean,
if you're going to tell me, okay, being American means understanding American football, I'm sorry, I refuse.
Well, there are Americans that don't understand.
Categorically. Because our friend took us, you know, like Dave took us out for the football game.
Uh-huh. I saw your picture.
Yeah, I tried. I really did.
You loved it.
I made an effort to understand the game. And this is me sitting over there going, that's rugby. That's soccer. Now, what on earth is that? I don't even know what that is. It's like, okay, they tried to play rugby but they didn't want to get hurt and they wanted like 80 pounds of padding. And soccer was too boring. So they decided to come up with this whole new game. And I'm like, I'm just so confused. I don't understand this.
Well, I'm not going to be able to save you from the football fans that are not going to like you for saying that. So I think that...
I made it to my first baseball game. So I guess that gives me points, right? So I've completed football and I've completed baseball.
That's good. I mean, I think that fits into the culture.
Yeah.
I mean, you need to, like... assimilate, whatever that means. Okay, so let's kind of bring it all down to like the business part mm-hmm. of immigration. Now, you work with a lot of tech companies, mm-hmm. and why is it important for them to have a relationship with us, specifically with an immigration firm, as opposed to just like their internal legal department or their regular law firm?
Well, I mean, we've talked about this, right? Immigration is one area of the law which is changing all the time. It's subject to change, regulatory change, as time goes on. USCIS, which is the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Service, decides to make changes in terms of how they decide to handle certain petitions. Congress decides to change things, you know, time and again. And then there are, again, like I said, political winds, and so things change.
Mm-hmm.
Like one of the programs, for example, which has become famous, but which has also become a bone of contention amongst a lot of people, is the program called EB-5, which is the Foreign Investors Program, right? Now, that one allows high net worth individuals to, and some say some deridingly say, buy a green card or buy green residency in the U.S. if they invest $500,000 into a project in the United States.
Okay.
That program was set to expire September 29th.
Mm-hmm.
But because there is literally a waiting list of people that are high net worth individuals out of China and Brazil and India that are waiting to come into the United States, and they have enough money where they are willing to put $500,000 at risk
mm-hmm.
for the hope of a green card,
mm-hmm.
that program has now been extended until December 9th, or up to December 9th, right?
Okay.
So you have to be able to work with an attorney who is able to devote the kind of time and energy and effort it takes to understand where the law is now,
yeah.
what's likely to shift, what has shifted,
yeah.
and where are you now and what is in your best interest. Right, it's immigration law is one of those things where it's constantly changing. But like I said, it's also subject to political winds and regional winds, and it's just it's a very malleable area of the law.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's not one of those where you can sort of sit back and say, okay, this is where things were 3 months ago or 6 months ago. I'm pretty sure this is still where things are, because that's not necessarily the case.
Mm-hmm.
You really have to be working with people that really surround themselves with this every day,
mm-hmm.
That are willing to devote the time and energy into getting to know you, whether you're an individual or whether you're a business, right? What is it that you want now? What is the long-term goal? And what is the solution that fits both, mm-hmm. right? How do we get from point A to point B, meeting all of these goals that you have along the way? And what's the best way to do that for you? What's the best in terms of time? What's the best in terms of money? And what gets you the best result?
Yeah. And when it comes to tech companies, I think that people assume that all tech companies hire immigrant employees. Mm-hmm. But I've heard actually from you and from a few other people that some companies actually are so scared of the idea of going into the process that they maybe hire people who are less qualified.
Well,
or no, don't even consider that they could have that option.
There are enough tech companies that are completely spooked by how much liability companies take on when they take on a foreign national. Because it is a lot of liability for a company to take on when they have a foreign national employed. So there are enough companies that are sort of wary about, do I really want to go into these waters, right? Mm-hmm. Am I just better off where I am here? But then on the other hand, there's also, and I think, again, this is one of the other things that maybe doesn't make it onto the airwaves as much because it's not as easy on a soundbite, right? Companies have to go through a massive amount of paperwork to justify that they, number one, need that foreign national.
Yeah.
And two, that they have the ability to pay that person the prevailing wage, which is not set by the company. It's actually set by the government. So, and I think there's this, you know, there's this false perception, if you will, that foreign workers are being brought into the U.S. and that depresses the wage of U.S. workers, right, or U.S.-born workers, that these Indians or these techies are coming in and companies are hiring them because they're cheap. That's not actually the case.
Mm-hmm.
Because the government has taken a very strong role in terms of saying, this is the minimum that you must pay so that the wage of U.S. workers is not artificially depressed.
Mm-hmm.
So there's actually provisions, there are actually safety mechanisms and safety provisions within the law
mm-hmm.
that are meant to safeguard the mainstream community, if you will, for lack of a better term, right? Mm-hmm. But again, like I said, that's not the part of the rhetoric that comes out in the media as much.
Yeah.
Because it either doesn't fit the narrative
mm-hmm.
or it's not the soundbite that they want.
Or doesn't sell magazines and newspapers.
Exactly. Yeah.
And not that we sell many newspapers anymore. Okay, so this might seem like a silly question, but I think it's an important thing to talk about. Why, because you're an immigrant, does mm-hmm. that benefit, you know, tech company who would be looking for a law firm?
Again, I think because I've, like I said, you know, I've been through the process. I understand the process. I don't know that my being an immigrant in and of itself is a benefit. I think the fact that I speak different languages is a benefit.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that I understand different cultures and the way work is done in different cultures is a definite benefit.
Yeah. Right?
So I work with companies that have a presence in the U.S., but they often have a presence outside of the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So if they have an office in the U.S. and they also have an office in India, I understand what that means. I understand the difference in culture in terms of the way that the India office functions versus the way that the office in Redmond functions.
Yeah.
Right? And they're completely different cultures.
And it's easier for you to get work
done. Just because of the spaces that they occupy. And so if I'm having to work in terms of trying to get an employee from the India office over to the Redmond office, I know how to budget for time. And how to approach the people in the Redmond office versus the people in the India office, because culturally, there are very subtle differences.
Mm-hmm.
But it's important to know how to do that in a way that you don't end up spinning your wheels and stepping on people's toes culturally that is not appropriate.
Yeah.
Right. And so, like I said, I don't know that my necessarily being an immigrant is the benefit, but I think the fact that I speak the languages that I do, and that there is what I call cultural sensitivity and cultural competence in terms of navigating these waters between where my clients are versus where their businesses are and how they're trying to bring in people from different parts of the world. That makes a difference.
Yeah. Let's talk about your experience being an immigrant business owner. What is the most challenging thing doing business here in the United States?
I mean, I think there are different challenges. I don't, you know, apart from me being an immigrant, I think it's just being a business owner is just a roller coaster like no other. But I think not having grown up here has its separate set of challenges. I feel like I'm still sort of, you know, feet in two worlds. You know, and I'm still trying very much to try and figure that out.
Yeah, like who am I in this world kind of idea?
Well, I don't even know if it's so much like who am I in this world. It's more like the word that I often use for this is sort of like this conundrum. You know, it's like I go between like my the South Asian side of me and the now the, you know, going on 15 years of American side of me. And I'm like, okay, I'm not quite sure which side of me is speaking right now. I'm not quite sure what I'm supposed to be doing.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, I obviously I'm doing business in the United States, but I'm working with people that are often working with immigrants, and my clients are from all over the world, mm-hmm. right? So for the firm, as far as our tech and biotech clients are concerned, most of our tech and biotech clients are either from South Asia or from Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And so we work with them very differently. And that's not in terms of, you know, race, but interestingly, it's actually in terms of job areas. And it's interesting because we have, you know, when we have someone that's an engineer and we're working with someone that's an engineer, we know right off the bat that that person wants checklists.
Yeah.
And we know that when they come into the office, you know, like normally when we have clients come in and we leave a stack of papers in front of them and we say, okay, we need your signatures. All they want to know is, where do I sign?
Mm-hmm.
And we point and we explain it to them and tell them, this is what you're signing and this is what this says and here's where you sign. But generally speaking, for our engineers, they want everything sent to them 72 hours in advance.
Yeah.
So they can read everything,
be very
sign
detailed.
It,
yeah.
Bring it back to you, signed, tabbed, properly tabulated, numbered, perfectly put together.
Yeah.
And so we make adjustments in terms of who we're working with based on what they want or what they're likely to want.
Yeah.
So it's comfortable for them.
Yeah.
And again, I think culturally, this is you know, this is the other thing, is they're not going to say that that's what they want because they don't want to be offensive or they don't want to make you feel bad.
Mm-hmm.
But I've been doing this long enough where I will approach it and I will broach that subject and say, now I know that, you know, in the past when I've worked with people, they've sometimes asked for this. Would you prefer me to do this or do you not care? It's like, oh, yes, if that's okay. And I'm like, yeah, I was expecting you to ask for it, actually.
Well, one of the reasons that I'm very inspired by you and Orbit Law is that you have a vision to create a hub of immigrant-owned business owners, because yeah. It is challenging when you come to a new town. Like, you know, I moved from all the way across of the United States. You know, you have to get your own community, to build your mm-hmm. own community. And then once you get here, you still can become very isolated.
Yes.
You know, and that's not necessarily, I think, in just an immigrant thing, but just a big city kind of thing, period. But do you find that it's more apparent amongst the immigrant-owned businesses that they're a little bit more isolated and they have a harder time networking?
I think it depends on the community that you're from, honestly. Mm-hmm. Like, I think for me, that's very much true. I think that that's very true for me, being from the Nepali community. Number one, you know, the Nepali community in Seattle is not very large.
Yeah.
And out of that, the number of us that are female business owners is probably less than 5.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Mm-hmm. The number of us that are female business owners that happen to be in the law is exactly 1. You know, I suppose I could start a support group of 1 for myself, but I'm not quite sure how helpful that would be.
A support group.
I mean, so I think it depends on which community you're from, right? I mean, I think the Latino-Hispanic community, for example, they have a thriving Chamber of Commerce, the Latino-Hispanic Chamber of Commerce.
Yeah.
So there's definitely support there. There's definitely lessons to be learned that, you know, you can learn from each other. You can bounce ideas off of each other. You know, the Indian Chamber of Commerce is there too. The Chinese Chamber of Commerce is actually very, very active. So I think the longer the history of immigration in the U.S.,
mm-hmm.
The more you have a support group. I think the issue is with communities of color, with immigrant communities that are more recent mm-hmm. to the U.S., then we find ourselves being isolated because there aren't as many of us from our specific culture.
I see.
But if you look at the number of businesses in the U.S. on average that have been created over the years, immigrants on average create companies.
Mm-hmm.
They are more job creators. And that may be because, in a sense, they're not employable, if you will, because the skills that they bring aren't easily translatable to the U.S.
Yeah.
And so they're forced to innovate.
Yeah. Interesting.
Right? Which may not be such a bad thing. But most businesses in the U.S., if you look at studies and if you look at the research, most businesses in the U.S. have been started by immigrants. And again, I think that's because, like I said, when they come into the US, they don't always translate, right? So like, mm-hmm. for example, most of the clients that I work with that I've secured asylum for, I end up helping them start businesses because that's what they do. That's what they're going to end up doing.
That's awesome. And one of the things that you do currently with Orbit Law in order to create this community, mm-hmm. Is events, educational mm-hmm. events.
Yes.
Do you have any upcoming events that you want to talk about before?
Yes. So we actually just had one for companies, and we're really, really big on education for companies and HRs and people that wanted communities. So we just had two recent events. One was for companies and HR specifically on I-9 and compliance, staying in compliance with immigration form I-9 and audits as required by the Department of Labor and Immigration and Citizenship Services. And then this past Sunday, we had a free seminar for just members that wanted to come that had questions more on the family-based line of cases that we did at Burien Library this past Sunday. And now on the 18th of October, we're going to have another seminar at the office at the Medical Dental Building in Seattle on hiring foreign nationals. So what do companies need to know about? You know, how do you make sense of the alphabet soup that is immigration and nationality law? Mm-hmm. I don't know if, you know, how many people are familiar with it, but the reason I refer to it as an alphabet soup is because the visa classes, when you apply for immigration into the U.S., any sort of immigration visa into the U.S., they start at A and they end at Z.
Okay.
Right? So the visa classes are literally like A1, B1, C1, D1, all the way through Z. So I call it the alphabet soup because there's literally one alphabet that's ascribed to a particular type of visa, mm-hmm. but that means something. There are specific do's and don'ts ascribed to that
yeah.
letter, that yeah. alphabet
yeah.
that you need to be able to keep straight.
You're like a mad scientist of immigration law.
That's actually my new moniker, the mad scientist of immigration law. I'm going to have that as a tagline.
That's your new personal brand.
The mad scientist of immigration law. That's my new personal brand.
Okay, so that event is what? What? October what?
So that's October 18th.
October 18th.
From 5, well, we're saying 5:30, but it's actually networking into the event. And so that's going to be from 5:30 to about 7:30, 8:30.
And people who should come to that event are who?
We're targeting mainly CEOs and the HR.
HR, people who,
HR managers.
Who are interested in hiring foreign
people
nationals.
People that are interested in hiring or that are tasked with the responsibility of hiring foreign mm-hmm. nationals, but either feel like they don't quite understand the myriad different options that immigration law provides or that they just want more information mm-hmm. on it. Like, you know, if they've never done it before and it's way too confusing, I have no idea what on earth this means, this is the one you want to come for.
Okay. Now, if you want to go to this event, then you can contact Kripa at, should we give your email address?
Yes. It's kripa@orbitlawpllc.com.
And you can also go to the Facebook page, which is at Orbit Law. It's at Orbit Law, not Orbit Law PLLC.
The Facebook page is Orbit Law PLLC. The Twitter handle is at Orbit Law.
Orbit Law. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for being
thank
here today.
Thank you very much.
This was a very wonderful educational conversation. I learned a lot.
Thank you. This was a lot of fun.
What's radically distinct about Kripa is the why and how she does what she does. Why? When you listen to her story, she grew up in a home of activism and passion for social justice. It has very much informed her entire life trajectory and the charity and pro bono work that she does to this very day. And how? Well, she brings to the table this unique ability to make sense of the political, social, and economic challenges of recruiting foreign nationals. And that's helpful from a business perspective because it helps not only recruit talent from a technical legal perspective, but it's going to help also retain the talent from a cultural nuance perspective. When you think about what makes you radically distinct, don't just think about a couple jobs that you've had or a couple degrees that you have. Instead, think about the unique combination of all your skills and all your life experiences that come together to form something that only you bring to the table. That's what makes you radically distinct. And oftentimes what we do as people is we hide aspects of ourselves that we think aren't relevant and then end up showing up just like everybody else. When in fact, those are the things that would help you stand out amongst the people who look exactly like you on paper. Make sure that you figure out what those things are. What does make you radically distinct? And put those things out into the world. Hey, this is Jen Morgan. I want to empower you to be radically distinct. And there are many ways for us to work together. Whether you're an individual working on your career path or your life status, or you're a team or an organization, get a hold of me, jenmorgan.com. That's Jen with two N's, morgan.com. Email me, j@jenmorgan.com, and follow the show on Instagram and Facebook @radicallydistinct.